Hello there, listeners. Welcome to this four-way leadership election debate. It's it's the Linux Voice podcast, series 3, episode 4.
Episode 5?
Yeah, it's episode 5.
Yeah. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm David Cameron.
And I'm Nick Clegg.
And still to come in this fun-packed and clearly non-politically biased coalition-sponsored podcast, we have the news. There's a halfway reminder, finds of the fortnight. Some there may or may not be some neurons to vocalise.
Oh,
Mike,
there are two. I will let you know.
Excellent. And we have our internet famous voice of the masses. This podcast is brought to you by the same team that every month puts together Linux Voice magazine, which is a magazine about Linux. You can buy it in all over the place now. I lose track, actually. We're in Asda.
Mm-hmm. Tesco.
We're in WH Smith's, WH Smith's Travel.
We're in even more travel stores this month.
We are. And in the States, Barnes & Noble, and in Australia, Struth, Your Flaming Galah. I don't really know, to be honest. Anyway, let's crack on.
I know, actually, because somebody in Australia emailed me recently and asked where they could get a copy of the magazine, and our distributor sent me a nice helpful list of all the shops in Oz that stock the magazine. So if any Oz listeners want to get it, just email me, mike@linuxvoice.com, and I'll tell you where it is.
Oh, we should brilliant. Put it on a story on the linuxvoice.com.
Could do. They've just sent me this weird spreadsheet. So
no, no, enough of the spreadsheets. On with the podcast.
Okay.
They just have to be news.
Yeah, of course it bloody does.
Right, news. First up, some happenings in from our glorious leaders in Westminster in London.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Thanks to the glorious decision of our glorious leaders to make ODT, ODF, the Open Document Format, the standard for communications with us peasant public people. Microsoft has deigned to support it in their future versions of Microsoft Office. They've always claimed to support it, but it's always been a massive lie. They clearly haven't. They'll sort of just about load it, kind of, if you sort of hit it with a stick hard enough.
Yeah, well, there's a plugin on GitHub. That was a link they used to send out.
Yeah. But now, apparently, it's actually going to work with Office 365, their web thingy that may work every day or may not. Who knows? So this looks like it's good news. The government might actually be enforcing one of their yeah. open source supporting rules, which is good. They're not just writing them on paper and giving them yeah. to Nick Clegg to ignore.
Maybe we should explain to the considerable number of listeners who aren't in the United Kingdom that there's a general election, which means we get to choose our leaders in a matter of weeks' time over here. That's why there may be some mentioning of it.
Yeah, we get a choice of all the different eat-educated white males we could possibly want.
Yeah. I think I'm going to vote for a white male this year.
I'm going to vote for eaten educated white male number 2.
I haven't decided yet.
Now, I'm kind of torn because my local MP is actually, he does some really good stuff, but he's a Lib Dem, and yeah. I just don't trust any Lib Dem ever now.
Think of the students.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when they came for the students, I did not speak out because I... Yeah, I've still got 12 grand worth of debt.
I didn't pay my poll tax, and they took me to court.
Ooh.
Yeah, I should put that on my CV.
What happened in court?
I had to pay double the money, and I didn't pay that because I didn't have the money. And it went on for long enough that, if you remember, like after Margaret Thatcher was ousted and Major was thrown aside, they decided, oh, it was all such a bad idea. Let's kind of forget it. The legal fees involved in chasing everything is just not worth it.
You're telling me if I don't pay my taxes for long enough, it just disappears?
Yeah, possibly. And the poll tax was deeply unpopular, but yeah.
Yeah. Should we get back to technology?
Yeah, sorry.
More vaguely government-ish news. The PBC is giving away a million computers, sort of. They've designed this thing called the Microbit and told no one anything about it except putting up a photo of it. From the pic, as far as I can deduce, it's kind of an Arduino Leonardo, but cut into a pretty shape.
But it's going to need a computer.
Yes, it's going to need a computer, and all the computer people are supporting it. Microsoft are doing something, Raspberry Pi Foundation are doing something. At this point, we have no idea what anyone's doing, but they're all doing something, and that's the important thing.
It seems like a weird initiative to me. Why couldn't they just give away Raspberry Pis?
It seems like a very weird initiative. I think there's a few things behind it. I think the BBC, in its nature, wants to be apolitical, and they've said, oh, we can't give away Raspberry Pis because that will upset Microsoft.
No, it wouldn't. It's a charity foundation. Windows 10's going to run on Raspberry Pi too.
Well, yeah.
Think of it.
They can't be seen to pick winners, can they? They have to be scrupulously impartial on everything.
And I think there's
which, of course, they always are. Scotland.
I think there's this sort of memory of the glory days of the BBC Micro as well. They want to relive. If only they can make another computer, it will change the world in the same way that the BBC Micro did.
Yeah, and computing is important now, so they've probably got a huge budget to invest in digital skills.
Yeah.
But I suspect it's not going to do anything. It's not going to do what they need it to do. People are going to receive these things in the post, they'll plug it in, they'll have a quick play with it, and then they'll go back to doing whatever they were doing before.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be... I don't know. I mean, you could say you could give away Raspberry Pis, and they certainly could. Something like this is going to be easier for people to get to work, I think, because you should be able to plug this... I assume it's Arduino compatible. If it's not, they are idiotic. But assuming it is, that means you can plug it into any more or less computer, install something that's pretty easy to install, and run Blink and get it to flash.
Yeah,
most people could do that. If it was something that needed you to plug in a HDMI monitor, is my monitor HDMI, blah, 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 keyboard, all blah, 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 then that's a lot more work. This, you can plug it in, it'll work. If, I don't know, maybe it'll get kids excited about computers, which really is its only intention.
Okay, so I won't pull my judgment on it just yet.
Of course, I say this. I don't pay my BBC license fee, so I'm not a...
We're admitting to all kind of criminal liability in this podcast.
I don't have a
television. Yeah, you don't have a television.
Yes.
So I'm not funding this, but all you BBC license fee payers out there are.
I am actually a BBC license fee payer.
Right, let's get on to something a bit more Linux related, shall we? As I look down my list of views, very little of it's Linux related, actually. But GNU Manifesto, that's about as Linux as it can get, or GNU/Linux as it can get. The GNU Manifesto turns 30. Happy birthday, GNU.
Yeah.
It turned 30 on the 17th of March, didn't it?
Yeah.
Which is the date that Jimi Hendrix released his debut single in the UK, Purple Haze, 1967.
So an auspicious date.
Absolutely. The stars aligned for the GNU, for the, what is it? Is it 100 million thousand words?
The manifesto is quite short. It's basically the first thing that they put out that said this is what GNU is, and also that you do pronounce it GNU, not NU. And,
oh, got to get the important things in there.
Yeah.
And it's a recursive acronym.
Yes. But basically, it just says, you know, proprietary software is bad, software freedom's good, we're going to create a new operating system. It claims to have a kernel in it, which is intriguing.
Still, I mean, it's changed the world, really. It's changed the computing world. Just maybe changed the world. Thanks, Richard. Yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah. Okay, next up in the list of news, LibreOffice have released an online version of their software.
I know something about this because I did...
No, this is good news.
I did some journalistic stuff and I actually spoke to Michael Meeks. So Michael Meeks is... He works for... he is Collabora Productivity, which is like they're consultants and developers. I think he's in charge of the biggest group of LibreOffice developers, and then they kind of sell their expertise on to other companies. And one of these companies is called IceWarp, and they create a kind of a CMS system. Mm-hmm. And I think IceWarp are funding the development of LibreOffice Online, which is why they can say it's going to happen. At the moment, the code that you can download allows you to view documents and it doesn't really allow you to edit them. And that's because they're using the code from the Android client. If you remember, LibreOffice recently launched like an Android viewer. And what is interesting is that it uses something called the LibreOffice Kit, which is like a subset of VNC for rendering LibreOffice in small tiles that are then transferred to the client, whether that's running on Android or running in your web browser. And the web browser manages and caches these tiles and caches the documents, in fact. And the server just changes these small change tiles. It's a completely different way than the kind of HTML5 JavaScript way that other, like the own cloud document editor works. And basically should give us a full LibreOffice, for better or worse, experience in a browser. It, for better, really, because there are actually lots of other cloud solutions for document editing. There isn't a fully fledged Office suite, if you think about a spreadsheet or the word processor, available. And the fact that there is going to be one, and it's going to be open source and it's going to be LibreOffice, is, I think, really good news. And it's going to happen soon. Michael said that by the end of the year, there'll be this. You'll be able to use it. It's
kind of bizarre, isn't it, that we had like network transparency in the X window system like 25, 30 years ago, and now we're recreating it for something very similar but this time with a million levels more abstraction and overhead by going through a web browser.
Well, it doesn't need any kind of X, it doesn't need any kind of rendering engine to be installed. It's all done through LibreOffice Kit. It'll run on ARM, it'll run on, you know, so hopefully it'll be lightweight enough for all of us to run it on our NAS boxes and not rely on some kind of provider to provide the editing suite. So there's not much to show at the moment, which I think is a little bit disappointing when they make a big announcement. But by the end of the year, I'm excited by it because I used to use Google Docs all the time.
It really feels like there's a lot going on with LibreOffice at the moment. I just do worry a bit that they might be spreading themselves too thin with all the extra bits sticking on. But there's a lot of smart people there, so hopefully they know how many resources they've got and how it's all going to work.
And the good thing is that Michael explained that they're hugely ambitious in what they want to do, because he not only does he work for Collabora, he's also works for the Document Foundation. And it's finding people to pay for these things. And that's the challenge that they have and that we have and that open source has, and that people are used to installing LibreOffice for free and then not paying for support or not worrying about upgrades. And that's the challenge he has. And I think that's when they have these ideas and they put them in, they start implementing them. It's when like a company like IceWarp funds its development. And that's something we can't get enough of, is getting the word out that it's great. Free software is brilliant. We can all use it and it doesn't lock us in, but it's, you know, it still costs money to develop it. And giving money to people like the Document Foundation or LibreOffice initiatives, you know, helps make it better for all of us.
Yeah, it all sounds like we'll have some exciting stuff by the end of the year to play with. But now onto some news that's a little more current. Google have just released Arc, the app runtime for Chrome. This was sort of released a little while ago, but now it's a more general release. Essentially, it allows Android app developers to package up their apps so they'll run on any OS with Chrome, so Windows, Linux, etc., etc. And I remember when I first heard about this, I thought, actually, that's really exciting because it'll bring all these games to Linux and it'll, you know, allow you to watch Netflix and all that. But actually, we've already got loads of games now and all that stuff already works. So all this stuff I was excited about in Arc actually is all already here and I no longer really care about it.
Does it work?
Supposedly, I haven't actually tried it.
I have to try it because it is an interesting idea. I wonder if it would allow, you know, like the Ubuntu phone to run Android apps if they so choose to put Chromium on there or something.
I think it needs the proper Chrome, not Chromium.
Right.
There's probably some secret sauce in there somewhere.
It's still good. Yeah, I can't think of any Android apps that I'd use, but I like the idea.
Yeah. Suppose it does mean you could now run Microsoft Office on Linux.
Yeah, that's true.
If you really felt the desire to. But then you can already run the web app, so it doesn't really gain much from that. Yeah. It's an interesting little thing, but I don't think it's going to change the world massively. And that brings us to the end of our news section.
Great. Thanks, Ben.
Excellent news. Thanks, Ben.
So it's time for Finds of the 3 weeks, as this seems to be becoming a 3 weeks per podcast. As usual, I asked IRC just before we went live. And thank God there's been hundreds of messages. It seems to have sparked a whole conversation about 8-bit, which BBCs, Spectrums, Commodore 64s. I don't know how that happened. Firstly, there's a discovery find from Twisted Lucidity, who really just sent me a link to the Linux Beer Wunderberg. Is that what it's called, Mike?
It's the Linux Beer and Wandering.
Yeah, that's
Beer
right.
Vanderung.
We've talked about it before in previous years, and it sounds like a really... We've all said how great it sounds.
It does sound epic.
Linux Beer and Hiking in the Ardennen, which is it's in Wiltzen, Luxembourg. And this year it's been held on Sunday the 16th to Sunday the 23rd of August. Is that a week of beer and wandering? But it looks like a really good thing to go to.
Was it in the Ardennes?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Another find that was sent to me by Paul Waring. He reminded me that he'd sent it to info@linuxvoice.com, which does actually come to me. It's difficult sometimes to get proper emails for all the ones to, dear director, we are a manufacturing company in China, but anyway. I normally suggest this over IC, but I think it's going to be away. And my find is the Raspberry Pi 2 supports hardware virtualization, although enabling it isn't as simple as switching a flag in the BIOS. So he sent a couple of links. I think the first link is going to be enabling the virtualization extensions, and the second link is to running KVM and QMU on the Raspberry Pi 2. But I did see, when this became a news story, I did see some videos of people doing virtualization on the Raspberry Pi and thought that's an awesome idea for a tutorial. So it's a great find. I think we should probably try and cover it in a future issue. Who'd have thought such a little ARM thing could do it?
I didn't even know there was hardware virtualization on ARM chips, to be honest.
No, neither did I. I have no idea about its capabilities or performance. I imagine it's going to be incredibly modest, but it's still a really neat idea.
Well, you say that. I mean, you get pretty near native performance on proper virtualization. So if you've got effectively four cores or more powerful than the previous Raspberry Pi, you could run four times Raspberry Pi version 1 on it.
I must admit, I first started playing with virtualization a long time ago when computers were relatively slow and inefficient. So and it worked then for whatever we were using them for. So they're the two finds from IRC. There could be other finds. I think they had a discussion about which was the most effective April Fool's joke over the last couple of days, but I'm a little bit bored with the April Fool's.
No.
You guys on Reddit, have you seen the button?
No, I've not seen... Oh, no. Is that the Amazon one?
No.
I thought that was
a button.
There's
a button. It's hard to describe, really. There's a button, and anytime anyone on the internet presses it, it resets a timer to 60 seconds, so it's constantly counting down. And there's no idea what the point is, but it gives you a little flare, so it tells you what second you clicked it on in the countdown. So obviously there's hundreds of 60, well, millions probably of 60 seconds. There's loads of 59. But when you get down to 58, 57 seconds, very few people have done it.
Internet fail.
I haven't clicked it yet. You only ever get one click as well for your Reddit account.
So is it time for for my find of the fortnight?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. So this is another vicarious find, which comes to us from Hugh. Hello, Hugh. thanks ever so much for sending this in. He says, I remember a while back, when this was all fields, while doing tax stuff for the magazine, you, that's me, were delighted to find that the government had finally started adopting open standards on its website. Yes, as we mentioned in news, our alien overlords have been, you know, improving. Yes, and he's just found something similar. Hugh was on the gov.uk webpage that shows all the public holidays for the year and found that you can export the dates in .ics format. I simply downloaded the file, imported it into Contact and merged it into my personal calendar, and presto, I now have all public holidays recorded in Contact thanks to the government's use of open standards. Well done, government. Two bits of praise for the government in one podcast. That's incroyable.
Is there still a coalition government in this kind of no man's land between the election campaigns and the election itself? I guess there is.
I thought there wasn't. I thought that we don't have any MPs now.
That's, well, yeah.
So we don't.
So are we leaderless?
Adrift.
Yeah. Quick, pass through some terrible security snooping laws. Great.
Yeah, that is excellent. An excellent find from Hugh. Thanks a lot for that. It does seem to be coming in dribs and drabs, but at least it's coming. And I suppose, what other way could you implement open source, or rather open format rollout? You can't just change everything overnight. So this got to be just a really, really good sign of things to come.
It's a remarkable outbreak of common sense, really. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll go.
Oh, Mike's stepping
in. I got a find emailed to me from Tim Abel, or Abel, and he points to www.bountysource.com. Where people can post bounties to get features added to open source programs or get bugs fixed. So you pledge an amount of money, or multiple people can pledge an amount of money. It's sort of related to what we were talking about in the previous podcast. And then Orange, this is a good find that I got via Orange Dolphin on our very own Linux Voice forums. He points to a story on the Register about a match between two German basketball teams, Paderborn and Chemnitz, and it shows what goes wrong if you use Windows. And here's an excerpt from the Register story. As the home team in a match against Chemnitz, Paderborn were responsible for the large score display screen. The laptop controlling the screen crashed right before the start of the game, and upon restart insisted on installing automatic Windows updates. The game was supposed to start at 7:30 p.m., but after speaking to the referee, the team manager decided to wait for the screen before tip-off. With the Paderborn team desperate to hold on to their place in the league, it took 17 excruciating minutes for the Windows updates to be installed, 2 minutes longer than the team could afford. In an official statement, the Basketball Bundesliga confirmed that Paderborn had been relegated from the Pro A division because, according to the rules, if a game is interrupted for more than 15 minutes, the responsible team is considered to have lost the game. So, there we go. Don't use Windows as the moral of the story.
That's funny.
For anything, ever.
Have you had any of your own discoveries in, you know, the last 6 months, Mike?
Probably not. This system works really, really well for me now. It's great. I can focus on being completely unimaginative and unoriginal in every way.
Well, I've got my own really crappy discovery, actually. This is short. Actually, it's not. Of course it's not. It's brilliant. It's called KDE Connect. And it's a kind of, it's a technology in KDE that allows other things to hook into the RPC mechanism. But specifically, it's also an Android app that you can get through Google, but also through F-Droid. And it allows you to do things like share URLs from your desktop, notifications come up from your desktop on your phone. You can use your phone to emulate a touchpad, and which is useful if you're doing presentations, and multimedia control, lots of stuff like that. The app is already pretty mature and seems to work quite well. I've not tried it, is the caveat, because when I wanted to do the KDE frameworks, the KDE 5 version needed like half a dozen dependencies, and I didn't have the time to compile it before the podcast, but I will compile it and I will tell you how it works. But it looks like a really neat app.
How do you connect your phone to your computer? Does it have to be wired or can it do...
Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
I think there's some choice over that, but it should work. It should work over Wi-Fi.
Ooh.
So that's my find.
I've seen that app around before, and I've always seen it say, "Oh, you know, get Android notifications on your computer." And I thought, actually, what's the point in that? I can just look at my phone.
Yeah.
But actually, if it does quite a lot more, by the sounds of it, that's
yeah. I mean, if you leave your KDE computer running, or you go downstairs to make a cup of tea or something, and you know, you get a really important email that you have to rush upstairs to answer, I suppose that might. It's still neat.
Does it mean you get? Do you mean you get two notifications for every email, though? One from your phone and one from your email client.
Yeah, I guess so. Multimedia controls. That's quite good for presentations because we make lots of presentations. Anyway, that's my find. I discovered it myself.
Office anyway.
yeah. That leaves you, Ben, if you've got one.
That leaves me. I have a vicarious find as well. And I just realised I've completely forgotten who told me what it was. So, right, here we go. It's Les Waters. And what he sent me is raildar.co.uk/radar. And what it does is it shows you every train in the UK in real time moving around the country. So if cool. you're...
Every what?
Yeah, it's a bit interpolated. It's not completely definitely that's where the train is. But it's based on... there's some various sensors along the tracks, and when trains go past them, they... upload their data somewhere, and that data is public.
Wow.
So it uses that and maps trains around the country. So if you're sat, I don't know, in my local train station, which has a display that's always wrong and says trains have arrived when they clearly haven't, you can whip out your phone and look up where it actually is. I mean, all it does is mean you've got someone to be angry at rather than just... sitting there staring at a blank screen.
I'm very sorry that the
First Great Western would like to apologise for the late arrival of the... Yeah. Even my train late... But yesterday was 15 minutes late. It's the first train I've taken in 2 weeks. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, hang on. At Doncaster Station a while ago, I saw a poster that said that the UK's rail network is the... most improved rail network in Europe. And I'll send that to you, Grave, for addition into the podcast notes. It made me think of that that XKCD comic about the fastest growing religion.
Or our 2,000% Facebook performance this month.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently travelled, I don't know, it must have been 1,000 miles, maybe 2,000 miles by train from Budapest to Istanbul, and every one of the trains was on time, even the one that wasn't actually a train and was a bus. That one made me feel like home.
Okay, excellent. They're great finds. Thanks to everyone.
I do have more finds. I have actually, well, no,
another
I have,
find.
I have finds that people have sent to me. I spoke about getting a Chromebook last podcast.
Yeah.
And I've had quite a few people send me various messages about stuff, some about getting actual Linux installed on it. And I haven't looked into this too much because I said I don't actually want a pure Linux. I like having Chrome OS, and I like the fact that I just turn it on, it boots up into really quickly into a web browser environment that just works. You know, everything's installed, all the drivers are installed, all the everything I need just works. And I know it's a kiddie OS, which is why if I need to do anything serious, then I can cheroot into Linux and have a proper OS. And that system sort of works for me, because a lot of the stuff I do is just in the browser, and but I've still got the power behind it if I want. But one of the things I complained about before is the fact that it didn't have a delete key. And again, I've forgotten who it was who told me, so massive apologies. I'll get it in the podcast notes, hopefully. But... if you press Alt and Backspace, you get delete.
All right.
But it does... It's the perennial problem with computing stuff is how to find out how to do stuff. And stuff like that. I don't know what the solution to it is, but...
Yeah, yeah.
It's always annoying.
Google wants you to Google.
Yes, maybe that's what it is.
Okay, so there are fines. Thanks, everyone.
Well, is that a halfway reminder?
It's time for our halfway reminder. What's still to come? There's neurons, and there's the voice of the masses.
Wow.
But yes. now it's time for a bonus feature. It's a quick halftime quiz. So the 7-foot lizard creatures that form our government.
Hello.
The leader of the orange faction went to Westminster School. Current fees are, anyone have a guess?
£15,000 a week.
You're not far wrong, actually. It's £11,264 a term.
Hang on, which one's orange?
The Liberal Democrats are orange.
Aren't they yellow?
No, that's the SM. Well, they've made them more orange now on the telly to differentiate them from the SNP. Oh yeah, all right. And the leader of the blue alien faction went to Eton. Their fees are any guesses?
More than Westminster School.
More than Westminster. 2 points for Graham. That's
Is it even in some currency we can get? Is it in some super secret lizard people currency?
It's in confiscated Nazi gold.
And two peerages.
And it's
the 11,000 peasants.
£478.
You can have the tithe rights to Sky.
So, thus proving that Cameron's education was better than Clegg's, therefore vote Tory.
And on that bombshell, let's move on to the voice of the neurons, or vocalise your neurons, or whatever the cool kids are calling it. The first one comes from Stuart Malik, who says, over the past few weeks on the podcast, there has been a recurring discussion about donations to free and open source software projects, the consensus being that a platform should exist where you can enter a dollar amount of your choice, and that payment is paid to your chosen projects each and every month. These platforms are beginning to emerge already, however, not for software developers, but for artists, musicians, and general content creators. An example of such a platform is Patreon, where every time a content creator releases new content, you automatically give them a tip up to a monthly maximum. The content creators can also release perks, such as small side content, just for their subscribers. This system could easily be co-opted to work within the realms of software development, and I'm surprised it hasn't already. That's an interesting find there, actually, yeah. Stuart. We've talked about setting up something similar ourselves or trying to get involved. Of course, we're just monumentally busy with a magazine, but it's good to see there are other things like that out there. And then the next neuron is from Carl Peters, who says, this is my first email to the show, and I have to thank you all for your hard work and excellent magazine and podcast. I wanted to echo Phil the Sheep's experience of Windows and share my experience of installing Windows 7 recently. My 13-year-old son wanted Windows to play some old games, and after much harassment on his part, I finally capitulated and decided to set his machine up to dual boot Mint and Windows 7. Knowing in advance that Windows does not play nice with other operating systems, I backed up his existing machine, booted from a live USB key, and wiped the drive. I have an old copy of Windows 7, burnt to a blank CD from an online download that was legit, which I'd carefully written product key on. After loading the disk, going through what seemed like an infinitely long install process, I finally got to about the halfway stage where I had to enter said key. I tried and tried again, but the darn thing would not accept the key. After much head-scratching and Googling, I stumbled across a thought. Maybe this was an upgrade from an XP license. Cue much chuntering and dismay. So back to a live USB, delete partitions and recreate, install Windows XP this time. Easily said, but not so easily achieved. It takes an age and requires numerous reboots. Then install Windows 7, again taking an age and again requiring numerous reboots. Product key worked this time. Upgrades done, more reboots, proprietary NVIDIA drivers, more reboots. The whole process, ignoring my first botched attempt, took almost 4 hours. In comparison, installing Mint alongside was a breeze. 20 minutes, including resizing partitions, and everything was done. Year of the Linux desktop. If everyone had to install Windows, no one would use it. For me, Linux is better in every department. Yeah, Good point there, Carl. People often say one of the obstacles with Linux is that you have, for many people, you have to install it yourself. You know, and that's, people say, "Oh, that's complicated." But installing Windows is an even bigger mess because the installer, at least from what I've heard, I haven't installed Windows in a long time. But you know, there's no proper partitioning system. It doesn't recognise other operating systems well. It requires a million reboots. It's absolutely a horrendous, rubbish operating system. And that's that.
Awesome skills. Thanks, Mike. Now it's time for the voice of the masses. We asked a question that we do every month. What was that question? That was, what piece of free software can you not live without? What's indispensable to you? Unfortunately, the thread was killed by Joe Ressington, who wins with the very first reply, so we'll come back to him.
I did, I mean, I do normally try to group these things into, you know, categories so that to aid ease of discussion, but everyone had a different application, which tells its own story, really. So the things that people want to keep hold of that stop them from, you know, moving on, not that you ever would move from free software to proprietary, but the things that people find indispensable are Vim, Bash, grep, Inkscape, Blender, SSH, MySQL, a decent terminal emulator, GIMP, Tmux, MPlayer, PhotoRec, and a big bunch of other stuff. The diversity is key. What does anybody else think? What's anyone's, you know, one application that you can't live without on free software? Mike, what's yours?
Zed Snares. Actually, there are other SNES emulators out there, and I've heard that some of them are quite good. I think, really, in terms of like a tool that I just wouldn't want to switch to anything else, it would be Vim. I don't actually use Vim all that often, but when I do, I just relish in the raw power of it. I couldn't imagine having anything else.
Vim was a very popular one. Ben, what about you?
I don't know if it really counts as an application, but it's the package manager. So I guess it's also the services and everything behind that. And I'm not too fussed between apt-get or yum.
So. Ooh, heretic.
But every time I have to use Windows, it's just, oh, I need a bit of software and I don't want to install viruses and adware and, oh, just I don't understand how you can use a computer without a package manager. Yeah. It's just horrid.
What about, have you tried Slackware? Because that kind of doesn't have a package manager, does it?
I've never used it long term. I've installed it and had a bit of a play with it, but never used it seriously.
Graham, what about you? Some esoteric audio nonsense?
I don't really do much of that in Linux, unfortunately. SSH, I just can't imagine using Linux without SSH. Maybe on the desktop Firefox. I mean, I don't think the internet would be the same without the osmotic pressure of an open source web browser that is Firefox. But there are so many to choose from. It's a really difficult choice. KDE itself, you know, I love KDE. Have I ever mentioned that?
Once, I think like 6 years ago.
It's getting better and better. The latest release is just brilliant.
It's funny how KDE is always apparently getting better and faster. Every single release is the fastest yet. It's
2,000% KDE is Europe's most. Yes.
So, according to this, KDE 5 is faster than KDE 1. KDE 1 could run in 32 megs of RAM, so presumably KDE 5 can run in 16 megs.
Yeah. Well, I'm only allowed to choose one. SSH I use all the time. It's great.
Yeah.
What about you, Andrew? How about you?
I like LibreOffice, and it's background. It's just wallpaper, and I only really realize how much I like LibreOffice on the rare occasions when I have chance to use Microsoft Word, because it just does stuff wrong. It interpolates the thoughts that weren't in my head and mix things into numbered lists when I don't actually want them to be that. And there's an extra step. There seems to be like an extra unintuitive way of doing things that Microsoft Windows, that Word insists upon, that has just been designed out of LibreOffice, probably by the collaborative nature of its development. That, you know, features don't seem to be there just for the sake of it. They're there because people want them. But that's just my little thought. Toey. Not Toey. Mark Johnson. Mark Johnson says, I faced this scenario recently when I started a new job at an organisation that uses centrally managed Windows desktops. While I've installed many of the open source apps I use on Linux, I could have managed with proprietary Windows equivalents. What I found I really couldn't do without is a decent shell and terminal emulator. The Windows command prompt is so dire it doesn't bear talking about. Luckily, the Windows Git package, mysgit, comes with a bash shell, and the open source apps console 2 and console with a Q combine to give me a drop down terminal in the style of Tilda Gwake. Phew. And Toby says, in my job I have to use Microsoft Word quite a bit. I always feel such a feeling of relief when I am back to Vim. My colleagues are also slightly irritated that a lot of my documents end with colon WQ.
You see, if you do a GitHub search for colon WQ, it pulls up thousands and thousands.
It should just be just accepted syntax or a comment or something in most programming languages. That's what it is.
Is that how you get into an edit mode or something in Vim?
It's write and quit from Vim.
Although only like newbie Vim users do that. The best thing is shift and Z twice.
Oh, wow.
Yep, that writes and quits. And yeah.
Do you have to be in any particular... Well, presumably then you just get two capital letters if you're in edit mode.
Yeah, but you have to be in command mode, but just like using colon WQ.
To save yourself the extra one keystroke.
Yep. It all adds up.
We should look through GitHub for two capital Zs.
So I mentioned that that Joey Reckington has won the internet on this occasion. And his reply was as follows. This is a very tricky question, because although I favour certain pieces of software, the beauty of FOSS is that there's almost always an alternative. Were it not for Linux, I'd make do with BSD. Were it not for VLC, I'd use one of the other media players. Were it not for Apache, I'd use Nginx. Were it not for LibreOffice, I'd use OpenOffice or AviWord. And that, I think, encapsulates, dread as I am to say, it's all about choice, because clearly it isn't. The choice, you know, the ecosystem of choice means that there's just so much that the situation that, you know, this software is going to be taken away from you at gunpoint and you have to live without it, that will just never arise. Because, you know, the code is out there, it can be forked and it can be improved upon. Yeah, so if someone were to prize OpenOffice or LibreOffice from my cold dead hands, I'd just use AviWord.
It's like breakfast cereals. If somebody took away your Kellogg's cornflakes, you could get Asda's versions.
Yeah, and you could, if someone took away Vim, you could just start using Emacs.
Well, hang on a minute.
It's got evil mode.
It does have evil mode, yeah.
It's interesting no one mentioned the Linux kernel itself.
Well, no, because there's the Herd kernel, there's all sorts of viable kernels.
Yeah, there is Linux itself, that's true. I mean, there are so many things when you start to look at it. What level do you want to stop at?
Even if you took away the package manager that I use most often, which is apt-get, there's still yum. I can still, you know, bend my head around. Just learn a new syntax after 9 years.
It's actually exactly the same syntax for most things.
Oh, no, I still fear it. One last comment from... Actually, let me just find it. Control F. GIMP. Sultan of Swing says, rather than one... states one piece of FOSS I couldn't live without. I find that it's actually the choice of many FOSS projects that is most appealing. Inkscape, GIMP, LibreOffice Draw, all these have helped me out. Omniferous Implementer says, GIMP. Mind you, it's a stupid name. Couldn't we just change it to GIM, GNU Image Manipulator? Ben's another vote for GIMP, and 100% agree about the name. It gets odd looks. People assume I use Photoshop. I always expect odd looks when I say I use the GIMP. I always say its name and what it is in one sentence. Dale McGee, I, on the other hand, revel in saying, bring out the GIMP. You don't just launch that app. And I love the looks you get. Ah, lovely, lovely GIMP. So I think the upshot of this is that we all win.
Yeah.
Apart from Joe, who wins most heavily.
Excellent. Some great responses as well. It's a really good thread. It's a real reminder of how many applications, how much open software has like done. Is that it?
That's it. I think so, yeah. I've just done a Google search for Norfolk horn sheep and they look great. They look really tasty. I can't wait to pick one up. for the freezer, yes.
Yes. I wasn't going to say anything. Right, so that's it for episode 5. Thanks for sticking with us over the last 3 weeks' delays of the last few episodes. We'll try and get back on track for the next one because it'll be after our deadline.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll be fully refreshed then.
And we should be physically in the same room at some point next month or two. So we'll take that opportunity and record a deluxe edition.
Yeah.
For the same low price.
Okay.
Okay.
So, thanks for listening.
Thanks everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.